We are Harv Adventures, and this is The Bottom Line. Hi, I'm Melissa, and today we're speaking with Trini Woodall, founder and CEO of global beauty brand Trini London. Trini London is one of the quickest growing D2C startups in Europe and has the goal of empowering every woman with confidence to be their best. Trini's success as a beauty founder comes off the back of more than two decades of experience as a television presenter and makeover expert, working for shows such as The Oprah Winfrey Show and hosting What Not to Wear on BBC, and writing 11 fashion advice books. This episode, we'll talk about the beginnings of Trini's mission-driven company and how she found her niche in the global beauty market, and her advice for female founders who are raising capital and innovating in the beauty space. Let's get into it.
So just to dive right into it, could you please tell us how the Trini London brand came about? And we'd love to hear about your time making over women through TV and The Oprah Show. And when did you begin thinking about the Trini London concept?
I think my bug for making over women started when I was 6 and a half at boarding school, because it was like a drug. It was so wonderful, that feeling when you get somebody to shift how they feel about themselves. And I was terrible at school. I was not academic, and I was not lazy, but I just didn't push myself. And when I did finally push myself at 13 and went from 25th in the school, you know, class to 10th, my mum promised me a holiday in New York with my godmother. And I remember I went aged 14 to New York, and many things happened in New York. I was taken to Studio 54 by my godmother in a maroon Rolls Royce. And that was an experience in itself. First time I saw men kissing or smelt spliff, it was just really an eye-opener. It was a time in New York of very much poverty and luxury, all fighting with each other. And I went to Lord & Taylor. I had bad acne, and I went to the makeup counter at Lord & Taylor, and there was Clinique three-step. And it was mesmerizing, because my mother literally, when I had said I had acne, she said, here's Pond's cold cream, because she'd never in her life, and the hereditariness of her Scottish lovely family, had never experienced any skin issue. So she was the last person to give me advice. So my advice on skin and makeup and everything never came from that maternal, you know, route, which luckily with Lila and I, it does a bit. She still has her own mind. But so I Lord & Taylor was this exposure to me of the sophistication of the New York department store, which was not happening in the UK, and this incredible three-step process, which was like a computer to me. And I bought with, my parents had given me like $100 or $70 pocket money, but I spent all my pocket money on buying this set and a pair of high-heeled shoes, my first pair of high-heeled shoes. And that made me feel I was becoming a woman. It was so weird, but I remember this memory so strongly. And then as I progressed and I got into my first job, which I thought should be in finance, because my dad was in finance, and I didn't really love it. I did, you know, a few years on and off in it, in commodities trading and studying for my Series 3. And I would, you know, I always tell the story. I go on the subway and I would have the Wall Street Journal equivalent, the Financial Times on the outside. And on the inside, I've had like the New York Post. You know, it was that kind of feeling of what I'm feeling inside and what I want to project to the world. And I would always, I was on a very small salary, and I would kind of go into Miss Selfridge, an inexpensive store, and I'd change the buttons and I would do my makeup. And I always loved the metamorphosis that these things could give you. So when finally, age 29, we're winding the movie forward, I've tried five different careers, and I've tried entrepreneurship at 16, doing a little sock business and a bow business. Both ended in failure, but very enjoyable, and I learned a lot. I then found myself thinking, what do I actually want to do? You know, instead of what other people want me to do. And I thought, actually, what I've loved throughout this time since I was 6 and a half at boarding school is I've loved that feeling when people are in my bathroom and I'm making people over and I'm dressing them differently and I'm showing them their body shape. And I was always the person my friends and family would go to get advice. And I did tremendous amounts of research in my spare time on this. So I thought, let me make it my work. You know, if we can make our passion our work, it's the biggest joy to break through to that place. And so I did, and I got a lucky break. I met Susanna, who was my partner for 15 years when I was doing books and TV and Oprah. And we then started a column in the Telegraph, which is English, you know, the Daily Telegraph. And we did that for about 7 years. And from that column, it was a platform where we gained an audience and we found a niche of speaking to real women about, you know, this is in fashion, but how do I wear it? Or how do I do this makeup? It sort of had everything on it, skincare, makeup, accessories, clothing. So my reach of what people trusted me on at that stage was set. And then from that TV company, which is called Be Sky Be, which turned into Sky, approached me, a woman who had followed the column, and said, will you, you know, I want to do some TV on cable to do some makeover shows. So we did them. And they were terrible. They were done in our own home. There was a budget of $500 a show. They are buried somewhere and I hope they never come to life. But I kind of liked it. I liked the fact of making over these women, and there was something quirky in this show. And then we are doing the column, things are going well. We've done our first book, it's done okay. Haven't done TV properly yet. And I get my first bug for the internet and I start a little business with Susanna. She's having babies a bit, she's there. Because I thought, it's such an incredible global platform that you can tell information to women. It's not just UK. I loved the globalness of the internet. And this is 1999. So there wasn't really much for women on the internet as a destination. And I got some investment really quickly because we were in the dot-com mania in 99. And I raised $7.5 million from J.H. Whitney and Atlas Ventures. And really on the premise that we want to build destination for women that would be personalized and it would go into every area that was relevant to women. Not weirdly dissimilar to the evolution of what I'm doing today, but there was no path to profitability. We were going to get lots of research on women, which we would then use to finance the company, but women weren't buying online. So we were sending them back into retail. And so there was no way at that stage that one could make that a financial proposition. So after 2 years, it closed. And I remember feeling at the time, I'd literally done 16-hour days for 18 months, probably. It was properly alive. And I remember going to Arizona for a week to a retreat. Everything happens in America. My revelations, interestingly, do happen in America. So I'm in Arizona amongst the cacti. And I sort of think, okay, I need to be open for what comes next. I've still got the column. We're still doing a bit of stuff. I don't know what's in my future. Let me just be open. So I got back and a week later, the BBC rang and we got our first What Not to Wear commissioned based on our column. And from then I did TV for 10 years and I wrote 10 books with Susanna. And the second book we wrote, you know, the first book, 13,000 copies were sold. And the second book, The Power of Television, we sold 1 million copies, our What Not to Wear book. And I remember when that book came out and we took it to the States, that's when we first met Oprah as well. And we went on the Oprah show there to do our book. And with Oprah at that time, if you were unknown, she would sit you in the studio and then she would come in to her audience. And you're just sitting there as these two little peons from London. And she'd come in and be like, and they would, the mania for Oprah, which is still around today, thank God. And then she chatted to us and there was something she liked about us, which was lovely because our book went the next week to number one on the New York Times bestseller list. And we saw the power of Oprah. And I was introduced to the American woman, the heartland of the American woman, you know, that Midwest American woman and that audience. And then consequently, we did about 6 shows with Oprah. We did the Mom Jeans special SOS, where we went round Chicago, kind of stripping ladies off their mom jeans in the middle of department stores. It was totally random, but I really got to know that woman. And I really like that woman. She takes a long time to trust you, but when she trusts you, she's with you for life. And then in England, we stopped doing our TV show. We'd done it now for about 7 years and we were no longer flavor of the month, the life cycle of television. So we took a tiny show to MIPCOM in Cannes in Europe. And it was a sort of a little bit of What Not to Wear, but maybe more emotional. We'd done it in Belgium, very random this, but in Belgium, we had a small underwear business, which was called Magic Knickers business. It was called Magic. We called it the Magic Knicker Company. And it turned over, you know, a couple of million a year. It was a good business. And it was like Spanx. It was before Spanx. And the people who had it said, will you do a show in Belgium? You're not doing much in England anymore. And it would help promote the knicker. So we did the show. And that's the show they took to MIPCOM. And then I remember my agent called me and said, look, they want to do the show in 12 territories. And I presume they just want to buy the format. And they said, no, can you come there? And, you know, we had nothing in England. And this is where you've got to take life decisions. My income stream had gone from a lot of money per year to literally zero. Big mortgage. Got to go where we get paid. And that was, to me, you know, I had up that stage. I've maybe made over 2,000 women. And I got knowledge of the British woman and the American woman. But what the next 2.5, 3 years gave me, the next 3 years, was a knowledge of the women around the world. And we are a brand predominantly for women. So I'm going to talk about women. And, you know, I found that whether I was in Israel, Australia, or Scandinavia, or India, or America, how women felt about themselves, whatever their color of their skin, or their religion, or their family upbringing, was the same. Those emotions were the same. So I was getting lots of research during this time. And one of the biggest things when I did a makeover is women would see immediately first how their face had changed with makeup and the hair, and then they'd see their body. Because women look at what they want to look at first, and things they don't want to look at, they look at the last. Or they might go straight there and then just ignore the whole of themselves. So I also found with every single team of makeup artists that I use around the world, from Ignat in Poland to MAC in Israel, that all the lovely young makeup artists would have this education to put the red lip of the season on anyone. And they wouldn't look at that woman properly. They just looked at her as, you know, let's just put on what's trendy. And I would always have to at the end, just before the big sort of reveal show, I'd have to kind of go through the makeup floor and I'll say, look, you've got to change this, because look at their skin, hair, and eye. Look at the combination of that woman's skin, hair, and eye, and how you need to see, does she sit cool, mid, or warm? And that's your palette that you've got to use from the products to give her the look that suits her. Not the look that's in fashion, the look that suits her for where her face is at and everything. So I also had, at the same time, I was in my bathroom concurrently to this. So when I was traveling a lot, I would always want to take with me my favorite things, and I would mush them together, mush colors together. So instead of taking a huge makeup bag, I would just put everything in these little Muji containers in the consistency I wanted and the texture I wanted, and the colors I created in my bathroom. And whenever I was abroad, people would say, what's that? You know, I'm doing my makeup really quickly in the restroom, and I'd say, that's my makeup bag, as they were grappling with their big makeup bag. And they would then say, where can I buy it? And then I'll go, shit, you know, not there yet in my head. So came back to England. And by this stage, I was doing about, you know, 60, 70 flights a year. I had a daughter, Suzanne did too. And it was just, I just thought, enough, I've done TV enough. I want to do the next thing. And I had been really scared to make that decision to split with Susanna and to pursue something on my own, when also financially it would mean I'm starting from scratch, you know, because I'd had already a career. So I just kind of also thought, it's now or never. And you have that moment. I had that moment at 49. A lot of people have that now or never moment at 20, 30, 40, but mine happened at 49. And probably the worst time for it to happen, because lots of personal things in my life made it tricky for me to make those decisions where I had the responsibility of my daughter. And, you know, I was in a house that I couldn't afford to pay the mortgage. And to still say, I want to start my own business. But I stuck to that idea because I just knew I couldn't continue if I felt I hadn't tried. I really knew that. You know, by 49, I knew myself so well. And I really, for the first time, knew myself. And I knew what motivated me. And I knew what gave me joy. And that making up of women and that being able to transform how they feel about themselves is my drug. And I'd found the products in which to immediately do that for a woman. So I then did a little SEIS round in the UK, which is like an entrepreneur's investment scheme. And I raised £150,000, which is like $210,000. And I got that initial investment. And I was starting from scratch. I had no idea how to make the products, how to design them. I knew the design I wanted. So I found a really nice designer. I said, this is what I want. And then we kind of worked on that design. And then we sent it off to get prototypes. The first 10 prototypes, I cried every single time they came back. I was so like, it has to click and be beautiful and compact and airtight. But we got there. And with the colors and the consistency, you know, I would send to the lab, this is the consistency I need for this product, and it needs to go on seamlessly, and everything must become a part of somebody's skin. I don't want anything to sit on top of women's skin. I'm so fed up with products that sit on top of women's skin. So that took a long time, because I'm working with labs that have done more traditional formulas. So we got there in the end. And then I looked at how I want to sell it, and I knew I wanted to get it personalized for women. So very quickly for me, retail was not an option. And that bug of that 1999 feeling of, actually, I love online. I just thought that's where it's got to be. And I've got to take a classic consumer who wants it to come to a department store near her and convince her it's better to buy it online. So how am I going to do that? So I just listened to all those thoughts I had inside my head of all those consumers who've said to me, I go up to the beauty counter, there's 20 red lipsticks. Which one do I suit? You know, I get somebody to put on my makeup and they're too young, too old, too much makeup on, too little makeup on. I have a particular skin tone. I go outside and I'm orange, or I've got a white cast behind my skin, or they don't understand my skin tone, my ethnicity, and how to look at the right matching. And I kind of said, I want to solve all those problems, and I want you to do it without having to touch the makeup. So I've got to do a very clever personalization online. And then I worked on that. And when I started, I had about 500 women in my bathroom, and they all put together, you know, I did looks on them with myself and other makeup artists. And we refined what suits a woman and why does it suit her? What suits a woman and why does it suit her? And that became Match to Me.
I'm sure a lot of our listeners can relate to your path of moving from working into commodities to doing what you love, and especially, you know, committing to that passion of making up women and helping women, you know, really revisit their beauty. I just wanted to revisit back to the beginning of Trini London and when this concept was developed. We read that you invited over 500 women for makeovers to your house as a way of manually arriving at your algorithm before the launch of Trini London. So what was your feedback you received from this early market validation process before and during your launch?
Well, I have a thing about market research, because I don't always think it's beneficial. And I think it's very good to reinforce belief, or in certain circumstances it works. So we did some blind market research testing, because somebody suggested, why do you do it? And we didn't tell them who the brand was. And we said, if you got makeup like this and it was cream based and it was portable, what would you think? And they were like, oh, I don't know. It's like, when you do market research on something that doesn't exist yet, it's really difficult to get feedback. But when I had the initial 50 products and 50 colors, and I had women I was making over, and they would look at their face after I'd made them over in the mirror, and they were like, I've never felt like this, you know. And I had that time again, because you had a woman looking at her face with colors that suited her and with textures that she, you know, many women when they're made over in a chair will either think, God, she's going to put so much makeup on, I'm going to get up and think, no, I'm going to have to wipe it all off in the restroom, you know, or they'll just think, what was that? And it was just for you to get a woman who gets out of a chair and looks in the mirror and goes, this is a face I've wanted to see for a few years, you know, or something, or I don't feel it's too much, or it's a part of my skin. If they begin to repeat things that you feel, that's what I want the brand to be, that's when you kind of think, we're on the right track here. And I think I had that moment in my bathroom, and we had all the products on this big chart. And as they came, we, you know, ticked the products they suited and crossed out the ones they didn't. And from that, we built the algorithm, because we then saw there were these patterns, because I didn't know what that, you know, when you attach inclusions and exclusions around a product and you're making this back-end database to actually analyze which products you suit, you've got to give great associations to the person coming in, to their skin, hair, and eye, and great associations to the product. And there were, you know, 3,600 scenarios, and how are you going to bring them down to a refined set of choices for each woman that feels unique, gives them enough of what they want so they still have choice, doesn't refine it too much that they feel, but I liked the pink eyeshadow, you know, but it sort of grades it in what you most suit, you know, so the premise of how you tell them that's what you most suit, you can buy anything, but guidelines, you know, and one-to-one matching on skin products was key. Getting women to, we spent forever getting women to describe subjectively the color of their skin versus reading what they felt was the color of their skin. And we spent months on that, because how you describe your skin tone compared to how I see your skin tone is very different. And I think that getting a match to me around foundation and around, you know, those kind of products is really hard to do. And we have about 75% of our customers do match to me. And, you know, they get the makeups through doing that process, and they get one-to-one matches on skin. So I think the way that you get the lifetime value of a customer and a very nice AOV in a basket is when a woman went to a store and it didn't work, but she ordered it online, she got it home and it was the right shade. And that's when you really, it's about trust. And those early months when you're building a business, it's, you know, you can do a ton of marketing and everything, but we did not so much marketing. We didn't do too much paid. It was sort of organic. I had a bit of a following on social. I had a vague TV following where they might know me for one thing, but not for this. So, you know, there was a kind of, I'll try it maybe and I'll see, you know, I know she made over those women, or, you know. But that slowly built. And when people got the products and then they tell their friends, and you have this score, which you do about your what's the percentage that you would recommend it to a friend. And we always had like a score between 83 and 89% on that. And I think that's because the match to me builds that trust, which then makes you think, do try it. So, you know, if I do a social now and I just do my makeup and somebody's saying, oh, should I do match to me? And the amount of people on that live will say, trust it, it works, I've done it. You know, and it's incredible to have a community. And life is very much in Trini London Land about our community. That they come in and they answer for us as a brand. There's no financial exchange, but they come and they go, yes, do this, and yes, this is good. And, you know, it's like I had it this morning or something, and it's just, I thought we are so lucky that we have that, and that strength of those initial customers and new customers who feel that we're more than just a makeup brand. And, you know, strategically for us as a brand, that's very important, because we you know, this is the first vertical, and as we grow, we have, you know, another one next year, early next year, and then more things we're doing. And it's about how can you make an incredibly good personalized service for women online. That is we are predominantly a D2C brand, but it is that. How do you do that for a woman so she feels she can trust that Trini London will deliver her those things?
Trini, it's so impressive how you've got a base of loyal lifetime value customers. To that point earlier that you were making on trust and community, how does social listening and really knowing your audience come into play, especially as you develop new products and potentially new verticals, like you were saying earlier?
I think it's a balance, because when you're at the beginning, you're developing what you think the consumer needs in their life. You're not developing what the consumer is telling you to develop. And I think when you evolve as a brand and you begin to get a customer base, you've got a certain type of woman coming to your brand. And then we have a very big team that looks after community, because we get about 3,000 comments a day across our social media channels. So we are sifting and looking at those with 9 members of that community team to look at what are women feeling about it. And then you have the TLC customer service team, which is 14 people. And they're looking at, you know, how are customers reacting to products and what's going on there. And all of that then is fed back into MPD and marketing. So we think, should we tweak our messaging here? And, you know, they all want this product. You know, a lot of the things they want are already maybe an MPD development, okay, but they don't know that yet. But so then they just think we're a magician and turned it around quickly. But, you know, at the moment there's a real like, please, can we have this product? And it's something I know that's coming out in a few weeks. So I'm just like, I have to keep my mouth shut. That's probably how it works. And I think it is a balance, because they're coming to you because you're going to introduce them something they didn't know about, as opposed to, I'm going to the store and I just need a red lip. We're not that brand to just come and find a red lip at. So it's about, what do you think you want to be for your customer, and how do you own that exclusively? So your competition with other brands there is slightly different. So, you know, if I look at other makeup brands, what we offer compared to other makeup brands, to me, I think is a very different proposition. And if you dilute too much what that proposition is, you become like every other brand.
Yeah, it sounds like an incredibly strong value proposition. I feel like that's been such a consistent message for you throughout your career, like really knowing what it is that you advocate for and being so values driven. That's something that I really admire. I just want to revisit the process of like you raising funds for Trini London. Wondering if it was difficult to get in front of like primarily male partners at VCs and pitch them, either at the seed stage or later, like
How did investors receive the concept of an inclusive beauty brand that helps women feel confident? Like, did they get it, or like, did it take some level of convincing?
Well, at pre-seed, it's easy because pre-seed, people are investing in you, you know, so that was an easiest stage. Seed stage, we were going out, I saw 29 VCs before Unilever Ventures said they were interested. And I remember in those meetings, it's when, as an entrepreneur, you have to so believe in your proposition, because they will have had the last person pitching to them in a room. They'll have picked up a bit of like, that's where the future, that industry is going. They'll then have you pitching to them, and they'll be thinking, why don't you do this and separate them out and make that a, you know, generic personalized service online? And why don't you keep your nice little portable stackable makeup and sell it in a retail environment? And I'm like, because the two together are unique and the two separate 101 people are doing. So when you leave those meetings, which you know when you leave the door, that, you know, when the men are sitting back, let me just get body language right for you here, as we're on a podcast, but I'm putting one leg over the other in a male way, and I'm putting my hands behind my head and I'm leaning backwards. And when you have like eight men in a semicircle talking to you like that, you know they're not going to invest. Whereas, you know, at Unilever, we had the guy from Unilever just standing there nicely, you know, sitting there nicely, and we had the two ladies going, tell me more. So you get a sense. And I think I learned a lot when I was pitching. I learned about, there are different ways men and women pitch. I do feel that. Sometimes we can be a more masculine woman or a more feminine man. But I always want to say, let me tell you the whole picture, because I want you to sit in this vision with me. And I did that a lot at the beginning, and it was too much in an investment committee for them to focus on. It was like, where do I look? And I realized that slowly when I was thinking, why didn't they get it? And I thought maybe they couldn't see one really good thing they could attach onto, you know? So I think I learned that a bit. So then when I was going into further meetings, I thought, okay, what am I going to do differently, me, when I present my idea? So I really want them to understand it. So let me just focus on fewer things. Focus on one main thing and maybe bring in a second. That then helped. And then by the time, you know, 3 months in, and when I went sat in front of Unilever, they then got it. And I was probably ready. It was a mixture. But it was predominantly, you know, when I went to that one meeting, which is from a nameless VC, I remember the woman afterwards called me and said, look, can I invest personally? She was the only woman in the room. And I was like, I know it's a good idea, but how nice you said that, because it helped me to reinforce when I might have a loss of faith moment, when I'm feeling, you know, that moment when you haven't got investment yet and you're thinking the money's running out. What can I sell in the house to keep going? Got a little overhead now and you haven't raised yet. So yeah, I learned a lot in that process, and it's never easy. You know, once I launched, we did another raise, and because we weren't doing a sort of blitzkrieg high churn business model, and I was really just loving long-term cohort value and seeing that as a future foundation of a strong, solid business, but the market wasn't looking at the market that time. That wasn't the easiest raise, that second raise. Even though we'd launched, we had a nice customer base, it was like, you should be 80% new customers, 20% existing, you know? And I was thinking, no, you need a solid base of strong customer base, and you're slowly building that new customer thing. And I remember that was like, they wanted maybe the hockey stick concept then in that second round, which was like our Series A, half, you know, like our, it's sort of like our seed-ish Series A. So then that hockey stick revenue, you know, at the beginning of, well, like just before COVID, we started to see that. And I feel we had had by then a solid enough base of customers with this very strong AOV, lifetime value, which wasn't decreasing. You know, AOV was at £80 when we launched. It's now, you know, in the 70s somewhere, but it's like, it's a very good one, and our lifetime value is increasing. And, you know, now those figures are some, you know, when people look at and judge us as a business, they are very excited by those figures, because it does mean we're growing a solid, strong business.
What an incredible story of women investors really supporting women founders. My follow-up question to that is, would you advise that female founders seek investment from specialist funds and female investors, or would you say that they should try their chances with generalist funds?
It's such It's a really tricky question because, you know, I went to see a couple of female funds who did not invest in me. And, you know, I saw one who was a Silicon Valley investor, and she just said, you know, you need to own 100% of the business for me to invest in you. And I had a very high percentage of the business, but not 100%. And I just thought, oh, I don't know about that one. But anyway, she didn't. And then I had another fund based in the UK that was a female-led fund. And I just, they were interested and keen, but I don't know. I don't think by being in front of women, you're necessarily going to get the investment. And I think we live in a world today where I think men are really maybe different even 3 years ago in terms of that environment. So I think it's about, not is that a man or woman in front of me, but who is the character I'm talking to? And what language do I need to use so they really understand my proposition? And that's about really measuring quite quickly what that person is like, or that group of people are like. And maybe even just saying, you know, what kind of, even at the very beginning of that round, like what kind of companies have you seen and what do you love? Even before you go in there, because all you want to do is go in there and say, this is us, let me tell you. But just even start that meeting off and see how they talk about other businesses, okay? And what they say and what has excited them. And just in those few minutes, it will give you a really helpful sense of the direction you take in presenting the investment to them.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I guess when you pitch and you develop experience getting in front of investors, you're probably able to make those decisions about character. Probably comes with like so much TV experience as well, like really knowing your audience. Yeah.
A little bit, because you have to really quickly sum people up. You know, you have to, on TV, what I learned to do, which has helped me in my career now, is you very quickly need to create an intimate relationship with somebody, you know, to get their trust. And you're doing that when you're making women over. And how can you do that in everything you do then? So creating that with investors is really important. Yeah.
Well, it certainly sounds like everything worked out for the best. I just want to pivot a little bit to COVID-19. And so did the pandemic affect Trini London's operations, direct-to-consumer model, or growth plan, both positively and negatively?
I think it was really fortunate that we had bought a lot of stock before COVID-19, because we would have had no idea when we'd done projections of stock how suddenly we were going to get another 300,000 customers when we had 350,000 customers, or 300,000 customers, 350,000 customers. So that was amazing. In the very, very beginning in March, we were really like, what should we do? Everyone stopped everything, literally. We were sort of all frozen in the headlights feeling. But quite quickly, we saw women were still buying makeup. And even though they could do nothing else at home and they're not going out, but our makeup is very, wear it every time, everyday makeup. And I did also, we had quite a strong social following that grew a lot. And I think that we were, you know, there was so much doom and gloom around. And on our different channels, we're very positive. And we kind of also say it like it is. We don't try and pretend everything is perfect. And I think that resonated, and it gave an opportunity for what I call that sleeping customer, who traditionally was waiting for us to come to a store, because we had by then maybe 2 million followers on social, but 300,000 customers, that there were a lot of people who we then realized those are people waiting for us to come. And now they're actually thinking, I'll buy online because I don't have an alternative. And now they've become online customers. So that was the huge hockey stick. We went from, you know, I think we did 11.9, or depending on how you look at it, 13 gross revenue to 45 million, you know, in a year in pounds. And that was a big growth. And we, you know, then with anything, with the pandemic, you know, you have a correction, because like everyone suddenly comes out, the sun is out, they want to go on holiday, everything. And then you think, oh my goodness, have we over projected our figures? But actually then there's another growth. So it's taught us a lot about teams, because we've also, the team went from 70 people, 75 people, and we're now 170. We knew we were behind on various things, you know, like Our tech team at the time was 9 people. Our tech team is now 41 people. Our marketing team was maybe 20 people. It's now 44. That includes paid social and design. And we do a lot of design and videography. So it's a big department in those. NPD was 8 people and it's now 25. Operations is now 10 people. So these things, it accelerated our having to, you know, the business was growing so fast and we had to really catch up with people. And then you're trying to build a community of Trini London's team on Zoom. So I think the biggest challenge was how do you make all those new people coming in the business feel this is a fantastic place to work? And I love how welcoming it is. And we did do that. I'm very proud of how as a team, all the existing team members made everyone else feel excited to be in the brand. And, you know, today we had our first big tech team meetup with sort of 40 people in the office just from tech. We've had to take another 2 floors. I'm meeting half of them for the first time. And just all the questions they're asking, you know, it's like they're catching up because they're like, where are you going and where are you heading? And, you know, they're greedy for knowledge of where the company is going. And I thought, this is so exciting and fantastic. And so we've had to learn very quickly on the hoof a lot of lessons in corporate structure, in growing from, you know, I always want to be a scrappy startup, but we are now in, you know, a proper growth phase of our business. And there's more grown-up things you have to then bring to the table, but still keep the emotional spirit of the company, that kind of joy and delight of that startup mentality where anything is possible and we can pivot here. And being D2C, we weren't affected by retail that much because we had like 5% of our revenue in retail. So we were the first ones to do virtual appointments online and 3,000 of them in one day went. So we realized there's a huge appetite for women who just want that knowledge before they buy. So we learned a lot of new experiences, which we brought into the post-COVID world. It's been, you know, for us, it was weirdly, in terms of business growth, the perfect storm. And I think it was very interesting as we grew in territories because we were bigger in the UK and then we had a lot of growth internationally as well. So we're about 56% UK and then we're about 10%, 11% America, we're about 16% Australia, and then the rest of the world. You know, we now ship to 175 countries. So that all, you know, distribution, now we do need to do localized distribution. We're changing our ERP system back end so that we can actually do that from things. So that's that next stage, a stages you face when your revenue goes from that sort of, you know, 50 to 75, 75 to 100, 120, where the infrastructure, so future proofing now is so key. And we have great people in the team, in that C-suite team. We got somebody who's our lead in tech and they're future-proofing our tech brilliantly just in terms of data. You know, suddenly all those customers, you need to really be looking at that data properly. And we just started on that data analysis journey and now that's incredibly exciting. You know, some businesses like ours are totally driven by data and we are not driven by it, but so influenced by it. And now we have the team to be able to really execute on that now in a far more sophisticated level. So that's so exciting, all the things we can do there. And, you know, innovation NPD, we now have the team to bring to life my 5 verticals inside my head and actually make them happen. So it's been a very, very testing, but exciting time.
Wow, what an incredible story of growth. It's super, super exciting. And I think part of what probably motivates your new employees so much is like your confidence and your authenticity. And so I wanted to end on that note because you're one of those like most refreshing leaders that I know that I've like that we've spoken to on the podcast. Wondering like, what is your hot take for women looking to take up space and to speak up and to shake up industries?
I think it's having that ability to believe in yourself and your proposition is really important. And there'll be days when you might be knocked sideways and it's just keeping that. So whatever else around you, and I can't say how you can do it, but I can say some of the things that as women we can do is we can shut the door to potential future. We can put a ceiling on where we think we can get to. And it's about not having any ceiling whatsoever. You know, the term the glass ceiling, I effing hate, because I think it makes you as a woman feel I've got to break through this thing, which is an imaginary goddamn thing. You know, so it's like, don't even see that thing there to begin with. You know, just think, because it's sort of easier when you're much younger to think anything's possible. And you can speak to young entrepreneurs and they're like, everything is possible. But maybe they have not got the experience to tell them what they feel isn't possible. And, you know, sometimes the older you are, you sort of think, well, that won't happen, because you can think of all the reasons why in the past, maybe that has not happened. And so I would say you never know what's behind the closed door. You just don't know. There's times when I was thinking, I'm never going to get the investment. There's no way, looking at all the things I have in play, that something could happen. And then something totally left field comes out, which you did not expect or not know about. And it helps you then get on the next path. So in those moments of feeling a loss of faith in yourself, remember you don't know what's behind the closed door.
Thank you so much for that, Trini. You've shared amazing lessons about like backing yourself, about building trust with the everyday woman behind Trini London, about being like a good judge of character, and like the highs and lows of your journey. It's honestly been amazing. Thank you so much for all of your time. We sincerely appreciate you telling us about your story.
And that's the bottom line. Thank you so much for listening. If you liked this podcast, please be sure to find us online at harvardventures.org. If you're a company interested in working with us, email us at hello@harvardventures.org. Follow our Instagram at @harvard_ventures and tune in next time for another episode of The Bottom Line.